All right, it is January 30th, 2013. I am Megan Falater, and I'm interviewing Ellen Jacks. Ellen, could you introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Ellen Jacks.
All right, and Ellen is a former graduate student and is an employee of UW-Madison, is that correct?
Correct, the general library system.
Great, okay, general library system. Great. And we are going to be talking about Ellen's experience during the protests in 2011 at the Capitol regarding Governor Scott Walker and the budget repair bill. And we'll also be talking a little bit about Ellen's experience working with the Campus Voices Project for their oral history program a few years ago. All right. So to begin, Ellen, can you tell me a little bit about what it is that brought you to Wisconsin and UW-Madison?
I came here in what, August 2003 to attend graduate school, and that was through the School of Music and the Ethnomusicology program. Originally, I was aiming to get a master's in ethnomusicology. Applied to a couple different programs and wound up choosing UW-Madison because, well, I had just been married, and the other option was Minneapolis, and that's where I'm from. So we decided to move to a different place. Neither one of us had lived in Madison before, so it was kind of a nice fresh start and a good balance between larger city attractions, but not too large of a city, still a bit of a small town feel. So that's kind of how I got here.
Great. What was it about ethnomusicology that you wanted to study, or what is it that drew you to that field?
Is the idea of it being just really interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary in its nature. I was a music major at my undergraduate level, and that was at Luther College, and there was so much of a focus on this idea of Western high art music, Western classical music, which I love. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there's too little of looking at a whole cultural context of a music. And again, I feel like there's too much of a focus on Western music in particular, and then high art versus classical versus folk, and this idea of high art versus low art. I kind of thought music was music, but also I was really interested in history and interested in culture, in language, instrumentations. So ethnomusicology really seemed to be able to fit that bill of looking at music within its own cultural context. Which a lot more scholars are doing with Western music, I should add. Because that is really truly how you can, or one very good way of determining, maybe what a composer or performer might have been thinking even in the 17th century by looking at a lot of the primary source material, what was happening historically, what was happening culturally. And that, in a sense, has been done in history and other fields for a little bit too, but this ethnomusicology was really kind of expanding more at this, in my mind, I was at least learning about it more at that point. So the idea where I could just go beyond Western music, and just look at a much wider picture to see where the music fits in.
Okay. How did you even learn about this field? I mean, it seems like a type of study that, I mean, not that it's esoteric, but one that not all undergraduates would necessarily be aware of. So.
Sure. Professor Juan Tony Guzman at Luther College introduced me to it. At that point, he was head of the jazz program there. So he alternated in this, I think it was maybe a spring term. But one year he would teach history of jazz, and then the next year he would teach world music. And so I actually took both of those classes because those were pretty much the only two classes that were not focused on Western music, or not direct, at least not focused on the classical side of it. And so that's where I heard the term ethnomusicology was in this world music culture class, or history of world music. I can't remember the exact course name. And we used a book called Worlds of Music by Jeffrey Todd Titon, big name in ethnomusicology. And actually, the section on Indonesian music was written by R.A. Sutton, who is a professor here. So when I was looking at grad schools and looking at faculty members, the whole application process, because you want to speak to maybe working with particular professors to try to get accepted into a school. I made the connection. I was like, oh, it's another reason why I chose here maybe is like, oh, I know that guy's name. You know, I read one of his book chapters. So it's this kind of level of recognition, too.
All right. Thank you. Did you come from a musical background, or is this something that you entered at Luther College?
No, I did have a musical background. Both my parents were very involved in music. My paternal grandfather worked extensively with the Cleveland Orchestra and Chorus. He was the manager there. So my dad definitely grew up going to the big fancy concerts. Mom grew up just being involved in music a lot. She was actually a music ed major in undergrad. So both of them have been kind of very influential on making sure my brother and I both had music lessons if we wanted them. I was very active in the church choir, school band, that sort of thing. Taking a little bit of music theory in high school. So I definitely had a music background. Nothing fancy, you know, I didn't do fine art centers exactly or anything like that, but definitely the interest. So that's what drove me looking to music programs for undergrad.
Okay. All right. And this musical background then was occurring in Minnesota?
Yeah, Minneapolis, specifically.
Okay, great. All right. So you are out of graduate school now.
Correct.
And could you tell me a little bit more about your current profession or what your professional interests are?
Sure. I actually wound up, so I got my master's in ethnomusicology and then started into the PhD program and got to what I like to call AABD. So I took my prelims. Certain aspects went all right, certain aspects did not. Kind of at the same time, my advisor was retiring. I could have redone a few things, but just decided that, you know, I sort of felt pigeonholed a little bit into going straight into my PhD work, but that was because I was offered funding for a year, and, you know, it's kind of hard to turn down a year's worth of tuition.
Sure.
And stipends.
Yeah.
And health insurance. Mm-hmm. So, not that I didn't enjoy the coursework, I really did, and I learned a lot, and I probably wouldn't be where I'm at right now without going through, having been where I've been. But basically, just realizing that, okay, I've got a master's in this field, what am I going to do with a PhD? Not a whole lot extra aside from getting a tenured position teaching ethnomusicology at a university or college. Not much else that I couldn't do with just the master's. And so I felt like some of it might be I was feeling a little pigeonholed or just not as excited about it as a PhD prospect as I was about just learning. And at the same time, I was taking a lot more courses in just general folklore and cross-listed courses with library science. So eventually, after kind of being part-time, taking some graduate courses here and there, not exactly tied into a program. I enrolled into library school as a special student and then got accepted officially for the fall of 2009. But I started already taking library courses before that.
Okay.
So now I graduated in 2011 with a master's in library science, also here from UW-Madison, and after stints working other places, I am now the grants librarian at Memorial Library.
Okay.
So it's kind of a windy journey to get here. But I should say part of what drew me to the library science is similar reasons to what drew me to ethnomusicology, in the sense that everything is kind of inherently interdisciplinary. You need to know a little bit about resources from this subject field, you know, some sciences, you have to help people from the humanities, you have to help people from music, history, and you just learn a lot by answering reference questions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what got me, part of what got me there, but also my first job at UW-Madison as a student was working in the music library. And so working in a small library on campus, but I was able to work in acquisitions. I was able to do some cataloging, did circulation, did reference work, and I did a lot of work in the sound studio, sound preservation studio, and with electronic reserves. So I had a really wide-ranging experience there. I realized that's actually what I really like doing, and you're still getting all these other aspects of what drew me to ethnomusicology. Just right now, obviously, I have a much less focus strictly on music, but...
Okay. Great, thank you. Part of what we're looking at in this interview is your experience with the protests in 2011. When did you first become involved in labor activism or politics?
I was looking at that question. I don't know how well I could pinpoint that. I always remember seeing and relishing in, like, you like the weekend, thank a union, you know, and all the stories and histories from the late 19th century, early 20th century about, you know, all the shootings of and union busting when all people were trying to do is to get a fair living wage, and especially not to have their kids have to work 10 hours a day. I mean, they're children. So I don't really know, I can't really pinpoint a time for that in terms of a general interest. Do you remember, it was in junior high, I'm dating myself here, when the first Gulf War broke out under Bush Sr., and I helped lead a walkout in junior high. We're out there yelling no blood for oil and marching around the block. I don't know that I necessarily knew what that meant exactly, except that I knew that the war was bad. That's what I felt, that the war was bad. I mean, my parents weren't necessarily happy with how things were going down politically. So that's probably my first... It was just a bunch of us going around telling people, let's all walk out at noon. And it worked. And I have to say that our administration of our school really, I think they handled things very well. They didn't belittle us. They were able to get us all back inside, but all the classes were canceled and everybody was to come to the auditorium. And if you had something that you needed to say, you could go up on stage and say it. And so it really gave people kind of an avenue to express why they're really upset or why there were people there in support of the war. So, we had people up there saying why they thought it was good that we were going in. So, I mean, I think that they handled that really well.
Yeah.
I think their main thing is they just want to know, like, the 11 and 12-year-olds off the street, 13-year-olds back in the building, at least.
What was the school's name?
Ramsey Junior High.
And this would be in Minneapolis?
Yeah, this is Minneapolis.
That is impressive.
Yeah.
Managed you all so well.
Yeah. I think it was part of, like, they got a few people to start coming in, and you know how kids are, you follow the fold, like, okay, it's time to go in now. Everybody's going back into the school, so you just hop in line and go on in.
Okay. Thank you. Do you have any other early memories of involvement in politics or labor activism? Did this extend into your undergraduate or graduate years?
It did. It did a little bit. Some of my friends' parents were quite liberal as well. So as I was kind of hearing, like, a little, like, underhanded, oh, that's so-and-so, but then it would explain why certain policies, social policies, might not be good or for the greater good in their mind. My best friend's mother was very involved in the school board, so I was kind of around it a little bit, not necessarily directly. My parents weren't directly involved in much having to do with politics or labor activism, but I was around it a little bit. And I like to play on the whole hippie persona a bit in high school, so I don't know, like, relishing kind of the social activism of the 60s. So I think that might have been part of a drive, just having to do with the whole counterculture, because I didn't feel like anyone should tell me what I'm supposed to wear or what I'm supposed to think or what I'm supposed to do. So therefore, I have to be a protester or I have to be speaking out in support of countercultures. So I think it was more of a mindset like that, or feeling like I had to live up to something like that, which I don't know how valid that really was, but I think that might have been some of my mindset. I'm not entirely certain. But just sort of being around people talking about things, and I've always been allowed to just express my opinions. But my parents would always throw things back at me, and so I better be able to defend my arguments. So I had to become knowledgeable if I was going to, like, be brazen. but then in college, I had a summer job canvassing for the Sierra Club and for the Human Rights Campaign. So I was going door to door, asking for tougher legislation for hate crimes, and also to help stop logging in national forests. And then that got me involved with some more people with the more peace movements in Minneapolis. There's a weapons manufacturer just outside of the cities that would send cluster bombs to about 26 different countries, including both India and Pakistan, Iraq and Kuwait, you know, so both sides of every conflict. And so that's when I started getting more involved with actual protesting. Okay. So we go there once a week.
Do you want to name the company, or would you prefer not to?
I will admit right now I cannot remember the name. I knew you were going to ask me that, and I'm drawing a complete blank. I'm happy to get back to you.
That would be great.
Yeah.
We'll do that later. So you did mention that this was... you had become involved in the peace movement. Do you remember approximately when this would have been?
This would have been about probably the summer of 1998 or 1999.
Okay. All right. Did this type of activism continue? Did you move into other types of activities instead? Or
not really. Just kind of staying current with what was happening. I'd be involved here and there. I was never really one of the ringleaders of anything. I just kind of come along for some of the protests. I believed in it. I believed in them. I believed in what I was canvassing for. Actually, that was my last summer living in Minneapolis. So I just... There are similar things in Decorah. I just didn't get involved in them.
Okay. Sure. Okay. Thank you. Let's bring you geographically to Madison. When did you first become involved with the TAA?
Let's see. I enrolled in fall of 2003. I got my first assistantship fall of 2004. So that might have been when I think that's when I first became part of the TAA, because I realized that I don't know if I necessarily knew about it my first year. I probably got emails but didn't pay attention. But when I realized, okay, I have this project assistant position, and part of why I have that is because of the TAA, that's when I became a member.
Okay.
And I stayed a member even when I didn't have an assistant position.
Okay. Did your association with the TAA change after 2004 when you first became involved in it?
Not really. I was just you know, I paid my dues.
All right.
I would go to an occasional meeting. I remember they had the strike. Was that spring of 2004?
I actually don't know.
Yeah, they had a 2-day strike. So I tried not to enter any buildings, and I was forced to have to go to one of my classes, and so I wore a black armband. And I'll admit, I found a sneaky way in, so I wouldn't have to go past anyone.
Okay. So then for the spring of 2011, did you have an assistantship at that time?
I did.
Okay.
I was a teaching assistant for a SLIS course, that's the School of Library and Information Studies. And this is one of our undergraduate courses, and this was Information Differences and Divides in a Multicultural Society.
Okay.
And there are 3 TAs, and we were all involved in the protests.
Okay. You say that you were involved in the protests. What did that entail for you?
For me, it was mainly just getting to the square every day.
Okay.
At first. and just to kind of help keep that presence up. And then I found the TA offices after a few days of being up there and into the Capitol, and just thought I'd see what they needed for help. And I frequently was wearing my TA shirt, so I would go around with one bag for trash and one bag for recycling, and I was just going through the square, asking anyone with trash recycling to give it to me. That way, trying to help it keep everything clean and tidy, which is one thing that most of the attendees have really stressed that they're very happy about, that how well we kept the place despite what reports came out said. I also did some data entry.
Okay.
For them, because they'll go around with lists of, I agree to sign the petition to recall, or people signing up that they would maybe like to be put on a volunteer list for future work. So I had helped to enter those. We had a whole series of spreadsheets. And then we cross-referenced those to make sure there weren't any duplicates, so people aren't getting 5 different emails.
Okay.
So I did some of that. So a little behind-the-scenes work when I needed to get away from a crowd.
Okay.
And I also brought some food on occasion. Fresh fruit in particular is something they're really hoping for.
Okay. Do you recall how you first learned about either the budget repair bill or about the protests that were taking place?
I was actually out of town. Okay, I'm glad you have this calendar here. I was out of town that weekend, Friday, February 11th, and I got back into town Monday, February 14th.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not part of those initial 2 days of going down and the I Heart UW. So that's actually kind of that's how I heard about the budget the budget repair bill was through the I Heart UW campaign. Governor Walker, please don't break my heart.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't there for the delivery, but I heard about it. And I heard something about a drastic budget repair bill and him trying to slide something under. That was the commentary I heard, the whole dropping the bomb commentary. So then I just started looking into it a little bit, mainly internet news sources. And then I heard, after I got back on campus on Tuesday the 15th, I was hearing about all these protests. And so I just went, I had about a 2 or 3 hour block free. So I just went on down to the square to see what was going on.
Okay.
And from that day forward, I was on the square for at least a period every day. I'm not sure when I stopped.
Okay. You've mentioned what some of your duties were while you were at the Capitol, mm-hmm. Handling trash and recycling, doing some data entry. What other memories or what other strong memories do you have of the protests?
Gosh, there are a lot. Just the coming together of so many people from various facets of life and of work. And just seeing people coming in from all the outlying areas in support of the movement. I met Jesse Jackson. I met Tammy Baldwin. Those were two amazing events. And then I was actually up there on West Washington when one of the high schools from all the way down, East High School, and then they marched all the way down. So I was there when they arrived. When they came up to the square, and I was kind of amazed at the commitment, because that was a miles long walk and it was not warm out. I felt that was moving, and of course the firefighters and the bagpipers, that was pretty moving. There's just a lot of good energy. People were really feeling like they could make a change and that maybe they would be listened to, and just sort of that positive feeling. And just trying to keep it away from being too angry. You know, there were a lot of people that were making sure that no one was being too angry because they didn't want anything to spin to give any opponents reason or any vindication.
Sure. Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by too angry?
Well, there are a lot of people really frustrated about the budget repair bill. You know, a lot of people were forced to retire before they wanted to because they were going to lose a lot of money. They felt like they were going to lose a lot of money. People realizing like, okay, I want to be a teacher, but I may not be able to afford to be one anymore because I'm just a substitute. And so there's just frustration frustrations can sometimes lead to anger, but I didn't really see any of that. And I think mm-hmm. that was kind of the point where if people are starting to boil over in frustration, someone was there to kind of calm down and be like, you know, we're here together. And it's like, you're right. We are. Let's go march. And I think that's more of what I mean of just like so many people, you know, just trying to keep it positive. Okay. Even when you're in week three.
Okay. When you were at the Capitol, was there a particular location in or around the Capitol that you tended to go to, or do you recall precisely where or in you would spend your time, or were you kind of everywhere?
I was kind of everywhere. Okay. Yeah. It really depended. If there was an organized speakers, I'll try to get over and at least hear some of that. In the square, I tended to focus a little bit, inside the Capitol, at least, excuse me, I tended to focus a little bit more on the upper levels where the TA office, the temporary office was, if anything. But in general, I would just kind of go with the flow, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. Most frequently, it would run into people I knew there, so sometimes... Well, I was going to go over here. Okay, well, I'll go with you. You know, it's time to do another loop around outside. Okay, let's go. That sort of thing. Or maybe take a break to go sit and eat lunch.
Okay. How many people did you end up meeting or noticing that you already knew at the Capitol? Is this something where you perhaps were finding people you knew
at
the protest?
Yeah, absolutely. I can't give you a number.
Okay.
I can say that definitely a lot of my students were up there. Not all of them, of course. I mean, well, I wouldn't know anyway. I can't see everybody, but I definitely ran into some of my students up there, which was heartening. Some supervisors. And actually, there is a large group of librarians that would get together in March. We met at the public library. And looking back on some of those pictures now, I realize I work with some I didn't know them yet.
Okay.
You know, so that's kind of fun hindsight now.
Okay. Is this a group of people you would want to identify by name, or?
I don't know how public they want to make things, so.
All right, that's fair.
Yeah.
Okay. You did spend some of your time in the Capitol building mm-hmm. Near the TAA office. And what type of contact level were you maintaining with the TAA during the protests?
Very minimal. I would just kind of pop in and see if they needed any help at that moment. And okay. if they didn't, I would maybe just leave some of my stuff there. It sort of depended on the day.
Okay.
Or I'd check in to see if they needed anything. You know, for the next day, if I could stop at the store, because there's some people that just didn't leave the Capitol building. But yeah, I'm not like on a first name basis with any of the officers or the main volunteer people. So, but I was on their email list and Facebook.
Okay. Well, but so you were then communicating verbally, though, by checking in at the office?
Yes.
Right?
Okay. Yeah.
All right. And you've mentioned email and Facebook. So would you be following news regarding the protest or the budget repair bill through those means, or were you following news through other types of means? How did you keep up with what was going on with the protests or with the budget repair bill during this time?
It depended. I listened to WART a lot, like our community radio station. They're pretty decent about giving updates. And actually, Facebook was really good for tracking what was happening because people would create events on Facebook and they'd get disseminated widely for when, for example, when Tom Morello came a couple of times, Jesse Jackson's coming. A lot of those events got posted widely on Facebook, so I'd follow that a bit. TA would send out emails as well. And then also just word of mouth. Classic word of mouth. I remember when something was about to go down. I was on my way home, but I used to just walk down to the square and then at least do a few loops around before I went home at the bare minimum, just to get, like I said, just to help maintain that presence. Because I figure I'm downtown, this is something I can do. I am forgetting now the... Yeah, this is when they were, without any notice, the finance committee was going to force that vote through, and it was an evening. I remember just I was up there, and there were people going around and being like the town crier and trying to get everybody just get in there, get in there, get in there. And I remember there was a guy riding on his bicycle around the square announcing it, and he was going up and down State Street and around the square and all off a lot of those little side shoots. So I guess when I'm saying town crier, I'm not really kidding, because he was announcing the news, and people would come out of like the coffee shops and the restaurants, and what's he doing? And then they hear it, and half of them would gather their things and would march straight down to the square, and from what I saw, and would go into the Capitol building. So there was definitely a word of mouth element if something was happening quickly.
Okay. Great. Let's see. You were following some media. You were listening to community radio. Do you feel that or were you or look? Sorry. Were you listening to other media as well? Or
a little bit. To be perfectly honest, I didn't have a whole lot of time. Mm-hmm. So I know some other people were tracking some of this a little bit more than I was, because I was also working, in addition to my teaching assistantship, I had two other jobs as well as this, so I didn't have a whole lot of extra time. All my time was spent at the square studying, or preparing for class and grading and whatnot. So I tried not to get sucked in too much to the widespread media representation, just because I didn't have as much of the time. That said, I felt like WART did a decent job. We did get some good coverage from John Nichols and Amy Goodman. Amy Goodman's from Democracy Now! I know she came a couple of times. I actually saw her interviewing John Nichols inside the square and filming her show. Initially, some of the larger media outlets had decent coverage because it was new, but that kind of tapered off. And they weren't very good about following through with possible erroneous stories. When the first report came out about the supposed damage to the Capitol, they estimated the damage in the millions. But this was based on some art curator coming in and saying, well, you know, I have to scrub each and everything with a toothbrush, basically, which was not accurate. You talk to any of the people in the Carpenters Union or anyone that's done woodwork, they would know that that's not true. Everything was done with the good frog tape or the blue tape that art restorers and painters and carpenters use. That doesn't really leave a residue. And then they had a follow-up report saying, you know, the amount was like one-third of the original. That story, the follow-up to correct the erroneous report, was not latched on. But that's typical of media these days anyway. Any kind of corrections to stories, doesn't matter what angle, they tend to not promote that as much. So that's not necessarily indicative of following this story, but of just poor journalistic practices in general.
Okay.
But some of the widespread media outlets just didn't really follow it. They didn't really get what was happening. And they're trying to make it all just about unions, which, as you probably are aware, it was not. It was also about access to health care. They really gutted Badger Care quite a bit, among a lot of other things. But they really focused on, oh, this is just all about unions. And so, therefore, only people here are unions and teachers. And so that I thought that aspect was missing, of like the larger picture of what's really all in the bill.
Okay. You mentioned that in addition to working as a teaching assistant, you also had two other jobs during the semester. What were you doing in addition to TAing?
I worked the reference desk at the music library. At this point, I was no longer working the oral history program at this point. I was earlier that semester, but the project had ended. But then I was also working through the university digital collections, scanning images actually from the music library. but I was technically working for the digital collections. So what was nice about that job is I just needed to work so many hours a week. But so as long as the music library is open, I could do it.
Okay.
So I was able to come in on the weekends to make up some of those hours that I had been working during the week. So I didn't miss any work through this.
How did you manage your time if you were working three jobs and also going to attend the protests and also working as a graduate student?
Yeah, I was a little crazed. I just made it a commitment. I just made like protesting a fourth job, actually. And I would get home in the evening and have dinner and study and prepare for teaching the next day if it was a night before teaching or... I don't know. I think I was only... Was I only taking two classes? I may have only been taking two classes because I had so many credits cross-listed from prior degree. So that helped. I could have been taking three. I'm drawing a blank now. Pretty sure I was only taking two though, so that helped. I mean, that's like, one class is almost like another part-time job. So yeah, definitely I was only taking two classes, so it's still full-time. But that's part of how I was able to manage my time.
Okay. You were TAing of course along with two other TAs.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have an opportunity to participate in? I believe there were some teach outs.
Mm-hmm. I did. But I didn't want to lose any actual class time, and we already had an online forum, an online website, a wiki, because part of what we wanted with the course was since we're talking about information divides. So we want to make sure that everybody knows how to do at least a little bit of basic web work. And so this was in the guise of a wiki, but they could do some coding, could make it as fancy or as unfancy as they wanted to. So I just created some discussion questions. These are the questions that we were going to talk about in person and created an online forum, and everybody participated. And then we reviewed them our next discussion section. And I also use this as a way of how do you interpret information? How do you gather information? Because that's also part of the information divide. It used to be called more of the digital divide of, okay, do you have a computer and an internet or don't you? A lot of people at least have access to a computer and internet now. But then what do you do with it? It's more of that kind of skills-based knowledge of like, okay, how do I find news or how do I find information relevant to me? How do I know that this is good information? So that's a lot more a part of the discussion around the information divide now. So the other two TAs and I got together and we decided to use this as a way way to talk about how do you interpret information? How do you know that something is quote unquote good? And actually, Professor Greg Downey, on his blog, he's a professor cross-listed, I think it's joint between the School of Journalism, Mass Communication, and Library School. He had this blog where he talked about how he looks and reads the news and how he, you know, he tries to get it from all angles, and then how does he sort it all out to know, okay, what is the most accurate? Okay, what gives you the best representation? So he had a whole blog post about that during the protests and right along the timing of a lot of the teach outs. And so we looked at that, and then we gathered a few other sources about interpreting information, and we made an in-class assignment with it, where pick a news story, any news story relating to coverage of the protests, and go through some of the criteria that was listed. So who's the author? Do you have any information on the author? Can you find any information on the author? Are they credible? As in, like, are they, based on what you can find, do you think that they can effectively speak to what they're writing about? Do they cite any of the sources? You know, so some of that basic, like, sorting through a piece of information to determine whether or not it's credible. But we use that for, you know, you can go to any news source you want. It doesn't matter. But then go through these and write up a little report on it. It was due at the end of class. And I had a lot of the students come and thank me after that, because it was a way to sort of them to, like, vent or express, but without it getting too political in class. Because I also didn't want to, students knew I clearly felt strongly about this. And not all of them agreed with me, and that's fine. This is part of rhetoric. You know, we need to have these discussions. But I didn't want that to take over without being related to the course. And so I had students on both sides of the issue thank me for the opportunity, because these two students in particular were excited about being able to express their sentiments and why they thought their news source was credible. As long as they could effectively argue why they thought it was credible, there's nothing wrong with that. And that's kind of just where we left it, and we just kept on with the syllabus after that. But we tried to, you know, all three of us TAs did this too. So it wasn't like it was just my class. But it was a good way to, like I said, tie in how to find good information or how do you determine something is credible, but using current events.
Okay, good. For the students when they were completing this assignment, you mentioned that you have students who are on opposite ends of the political spectrum, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Did you see a range of different news sources they were using, or?
A lot of them were just sort of mainstream news sites. Quite frankly, I think they're tied to their hometowns. So the TV station from their hometowns, I was noticing a lot of that. There were some, there are a couple Huffington Posts, a couple CNNs, a couple General Fox News. There was one Democracy Now. But by far and large, they're definitely local TV stations, local to, I'm imagining, to each student. It's what they know. Or could be.
No, that does make sense. Before we...
somewhere to their local newspapers as well.
Mm, okay. Before we move into talking about your work with the oral history program, are there any other thoughts or recollections regarding the protests at the Capitol that you wanted to share or talk about?
I could probably go on for hours if I allowed myself. Yeah, I don't know.
Let's see. How about, I could try rephrasing this. Looking back at your experiences with the protests, which began almost 2 years ago now, what is your overall impression or thought about either going through these protests yourself as a student or seeing Yeah, I'll just leave it there. So what is your overall impression of going through these protests as a person or as a graduate student?
Oh, I'm glad I did it. I wish it would have done a little bit more than it did. I was a little disappointed in some of the follow-through beyond that. But at the same time, it got people to talk about issues. And ultimately, I think that is important. Got people out of their own little bubbles and comfort zones to think about, well, what's happening more widely in the region. For a period, there was some definitely weird part of the national spotlight. That was a bit, some of that was kind of exciting. I saw a video of the night they ran through the budget bill through, and I could hear my voice. So that was kind of entertaining. But overall, I am very glad that it happened, that I did it. I wish some of the results had been different. I feel like more action needed to be taken immediately if we wanted to make it mean more than just drawing a national spotlight, which there's nothing wrong with that either. Yeah, I was there, you know? that's sort of the, I guess, the overall sentiment I have. I have a nice collection of signs.
Okay, could you tell me a little more about the signs? And are there any in particular that you collected or put together?
Well, I had a big one that I carried around with me. It was a big foam board that said, "Please do not shush me, librarians will not be silenced." And I did some of the words in red and some in black. So the ones in red then stood up. You just saw those from a distance. It said, "Do not shush librarians." And all the other words were in black. So I got a lot of compliments on that. And coming up, "Oh, yay, librarians," people would clap. Because, you know, and then somebody else, yeah, I heard, you know, some of the comments, like, "You know it's bad if the librarians are out." So that was fun. Then I had just negotiate sign. That was my first sign, is just negotiate, because that was the whole idea of just like, so you're going to just throw this on the table, but without giving us a chance to talk about it. You didn't even bring any of the other stakeholders to the table. I just had a problem with it, you know, just the lack of communication, a lack of willing to work out anything out. And I think that was a lot of people's impression too, from what I understand. A couple of the just sort of the general signs that AFL was giving out.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to have us switch gears for
sure.
The interview so that we can move back chronologically 1 year from then, or actually perhaps a bit more than that, to talk about your work with the oral history program at UW-Madison. How did you first become involved with the oral history program?
Actually through my folklore connections through Jim Leary. He let me know that Troy needed another student oral historian. And this was when they were working in the Forest Law, Forest Products Centennial Project. So this is in spring 2008 that I came on board. So I was doing mostly the processing of the interviews. I only did two myself, but like I said, that was kind of right at the end of, or towards the end of the interview portion of that project. So that's how I got on board. And then I've been kind of there on, or I was there on and off through spring 2011.
Okay. So you were then involved with the Campus Voices project with Troy Reeves, right? What was your experience with that project, or what do you recall at this point, 3 years later, in working with that project?
Yeah, I can't remember how much I was working there directly at that point. That might have been during a slight off, but then that brought me back on. But Troy, I believe, brought me in to help be a bit more of the technical side, work on extracting some of the audio segments. So I think, like I said earlier, I used to work at the sound studio at the music library, so I have a little experience with digitization and cleaning up audio files and clipping things and getting everything about the same volume. So Troy brought me on to help with that for the TAA strike project. And then I wound up helping the Corollary project, helping out with the story booth. So the bombing of Sterling Hall, and that led into another second Campus Voices project. So I was mainly working on extracting audio files, and I think I helped to sort through some of the ones that we might want in some of the possible clips to create the album, and to kind of give that the oral history of the TA strike and then of Sterling Hall in people's own voices. But again, I was mainly on the technical side.
Okay.
And I did the webpage as well.
Okay. So, I mean, in some ways, the tests that you were doing for Campus Voices were comparable to things you've been trained to do already, or that you were doing for your job in other ways to begin with.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Comparable, but also different,
okay.
Because at the oral history program, you're dealing with just a single voice, or at the music library, you're having a much wider frequency range. Because you might be digitizing something that's a full symphony orchestra or at least some kind of a musical ensemble that might have a lot of highs and a lot of lows. So the actual bit rate and conversion rates would be a little bit different. At Mills, we're always doing everything in stereo, and for the oral history, everything was put into mono. So there's some differences.
Okay.
There are some technical differences, but conceptually quite similar, yes.
Okay. Also in doing this, presumably in listening to interviews or conversations, might be having an opportunity to listen to the interviews that you're working on. What was your experience of getting to listen to other people's cross-street interviews?
In general, I just found everything fascinating. I love to hear people's stories. So that's just my overall impression, but I also had to be careful about not getting sucked in. There's always a lot of other work to be done. So I was mainly kind of clicking through quickly in terms of quality control, spot checking, and deciding what kind of process needs to run through to clean something up or to boost the volume if needed. Try to do as little as possible because you don't want to get rid of a person's the quality of their voice. Sometimes you kind of split the difference because you have to be able to hear what they're saying too. It was a really poor recording. But yeah, it was always interesting to hear people's stories. I enjoyed that aspect. And I also enjoyed the different media outputs that we'd use with Campus Voices, of having kind of the mini movie and working with the iTunes U album. And then just general straight up recordings, and then trying to get that all put on a web page. That part was a little bit new for me. At Mills, everything was a little different because a lot of what I was digitizing was just to save or conservation of the audio, preservation of the audio, or for e-reserves, which was a whole other system because only people enrolled in each class could access the file. That way it'd be fair use. So this is a little different with that. So there are different outputs, I guess. But I really enjoyed that.
What was your experience of trying to put these different types of output onto the Oral History Program's webpage? Did you run into any challenges or surprises? Or
I did at times. It depended on... this is sort of more with the general oral history page, not necessarily Campus Voices, but from some conferences, keynote speakers, one of those on the webpage, we had permission from the speakers just to put them up there others could listen. We had to have kind of a hosting service, so we used this, and then an embedded player. So we used this, it was recommended to us, this player called Flow Player, but it would start, it would autoplay. And I had three different keynotes on there. And so you load the page and they're all playing at once. And it was kind of funny, but also it's like, how do I get this to stop? And so I got to play around with a lot of code and I eventually figured it out. So I was proud of myself for that, which is probably very menial to anyone who does a lot of programming or a lot of coding, but I didn't do a heck of a lot at that point. But I got to work more with JavaScript. I got to work a little bit with Flash. And that's something that I hadn't done too much of before. So it helped me to, you know, I'd learned a little bit in various classes or a little bit here and there on my own. So it was nice to kind of apply some of those skills.
How time-consuming would it be to try to create that web page or to maintain it or, you know, create some of these updates to it?
I'd have to look at it again. I think knowing now what I know, it probably wouldn't take too long. And I know that's not a real specific answer.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking partly, too, just, like, learning the process. I mean, it seems like something that would be very difficult to try out, so particularly the first few times that it's done. So, I mean, I'm trying to get a sense for the amount of, I mean, this seems like something that you would put a lot of labor into.
Well, and I tracked all of my work and I created a manual, a training manual. So all the coding exceptions I had to do, I put in text format in that manual so people wouldn't, they could just copy the code.
Great.
And step-by-step instructions on uploading files and linking properly to the iTunes U album so that when you download it, the tracks stay in order. That was another issue. When you downloaded the album, the tracks, even if you labeled them 1, 2, 3, sometimes they would play in random order, and that's not really what we wanted. And it wasn't anything exactly having to do with hitting a random button, you know, play in a random order using iTunes. We actually had to put the track number into the title. So that was some trial and error, but again, that was all, I notated all of that and documented all of that. So, I don't think it would take too terribly long if all the documentation is still accurate from 2 years ago.
Okay. Impressive. Perhaps my inexperience with library work is showing here, but that you were able to not only learn to do something new yourself, but to create a process around it. Is this something that you've been able to do in some of your other types of work as a graduate student?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I did that at the music library as well. Partly because, you know, I've been doing the same work for a few years there, and I was graduating. And I know when I came into the position at Oral History, I took over the student office manager after the Forest Products Lab, or it might have been after Campus Voices, but in any case, somewhere in there. The prior student office manager didn't really leave any documentation of what she did. There's one who did it for a little bit after, and she sort of started typing up some of the stuff she did, and she showed me what she did. And I just think it's so important to have good documentation of in job descriptions. This is actually, a lot of librarians end up having to do something like this when they come onto a job, because the prior person might not have really left anything, because it's all knowledge in the person's head, and they might have trained people who may have gone on to do other things. So it's just something I started doing, mainly because I knew I was going to be leaving and I didn't want to leave anybody else hanging.
Sure. Okay. You are currently working with the Memorial Library.
Correct.
What are your future plans?
I'm going to stay here, I hope. I started working here at Memorial in the Reference Department as a research intern last year. And sort of, it's the equivalent of a postdoc, where, you know, full-time work and you get, you're on a salary. Very, very limited benefits, but it's considered professional experience, and it was only good for people who had graduated from a library school within the last 18 months at the time of application. So you're not competing against people that have 5 years experience outside of student work. So I did that for a year, and then last fall they announced that they received the funding to rehire a grants librarian full-time. So I applied for that, and that's also, that position is part of the reference department as well. So I had to go through the whole, I went through the whole search and screen process, phone interview, the day-long in-person interview with a public speaking component. And so I got the grants job, and I just started that this month. I hope to stay in the system here. I'm enjoying my work thus far. And in general, I want to stay with an academic librarianship.
Okay. What is it about an academic library or an academic librarianship that draws you?
Especially working in a reference department, it really ties into me being a bit of an academic mutt, I guess. I just have so many just interests that I'm not really an expert in a ton of them. But, you know, I studied math and science a bit in undergrad as well. I just find just learning about other disciplines kind of fascinating. So staying within, you know, reference or public service area of an academic library is a really good way to kind of keep a feel of what's happening in academia and higher education. But I still get to teach, because I enjoy teaching, but I don't have to maintain a whole course and maintain workshops. I help people a lot in a one-on-one situation, in appointment settings. And especially the grants position, I help people from all backgrounds. We get a lot of people coming in, work with local nonprofits, people coming in just trying to get money to pay for tuition, both here on campus or anywhere else. We help whoever needs to come in. We help via phone, email. So it does get that working with the general public aspect in it as well, which I really like, because I don't want to be completely just, only academic types, if you will. It's good to maintain your relationships widely. And I feel like this position does that nicely.
Okay. Do you wish to share any final thoughts?
I'm surprisingly speechless for someone who's been babbling on for a while.
Well, you've had an opportunity to say a lot of your thoughts.
Yeah. I'm happy I wound up where I did. Sometimes I wish I would have gotten to library school a little earlier, but I don't know if I would have this type of a passion for it if I did. I felt like I came to it naturally. I'm glad I attended the protests and feel good about standing up for something I believed in. So I guess that's probably a good way to end it.
All right. Thank you, Ellen, for talking to me today.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure.
All right. Thank you. All right, this is Megan Falater, and it is January 30th, 2013, and I'm talking with Ellen Barksdale-Jax, and Ellen wanted to add one other recollection from her experiences in 2011 at the Capitol in protests against the budget repair bill. Ellen?
In our kind of winding down here, really it's neglected to mention that, but even though I was up at the square every day, I didn't do the Capitol 24/7 exactly, but I did spend one night there. I felt like it was important. Like if I was going to be up there the whole time, I felt like I needed to get the full experience. And this wound up being the night that they the assembly ran the bill through, actually. So I did get a little sleep, I think starting around midnight or so. And then at about 1:30, there was just commotion. And this is when in the middle of the roll call, that they just decided to vote And it was a, you know, this is the, you know, the assembly portion, that the senators were still gone. But the assembly leaders decided that they were done getting statements from the public, even though they're supposed to maintain statements for the public. So this happened to be that night of all nights that I spent there. And my husband met me at the square and brought Thermarests and some camping gear and a little something for me to nibble on. And so, that was a really interesting experience. I had some people who couldn't spend the night, but they knew I was there and had come and found me. I had a little corner set up. There were some high school girls across the street, because school I was in school the next day. So some parents let their high school students stay there. The parents were there too, but not staying at the same spot to give their kids a little bit of freedom. But they kind of asked me to keep an eye out, which I did. Just a little bit of a courtesy. Like they felt better because they saw my sign. They're like, "Oh, she's a librarian. She's safe." So that was a really it was a really interesting experience to spend the night there. A big camping backpack. And then I actually went to work at Oral History the next day, trying my best to speak to that. I was a little tired, but I knew that was why I didn't have to teach or anything the next day. I didn't have any classes the next day. I just needed to go get some work done. So it seemed like that night was a good night to do that, so I could have the full experience. And I'm very glad I did. Yeah, to be there the night that the bill was ran through the assembly, it was pretty intense. There were a lot of very, very upset people. I did then get woken up a little while later. There's the commotion about the bill being rammed through out in the rotunda. And so I went around, took some pictures, and talked to some people for a little while. And then I eventually just went and laid back down. And then a couple hours later, I was woken up and was told I had to move. They were supposedly cleaning certain areas, which there's actually, you know, I don't know if they did. I don't know that they didn't. I didn't see it. That's all I can say to that. But the police officer, the security officer who woke me up, they're very, very kind. And just, you know, they didn't like pick you up and move you. They just, it's like, "Sorry to wake you up, but we're going to have to close off this section. I'm going to need you to move, please, at your convenience." If you're dawdling too much, they would come back around again, but they knew people were generally following the instructions. So those first few weeks, first couple of nights, from what I understand, most people weren't, sections weren't being closed off to sweep and mop the floors or anything. So there's some conspiracy theorists, of course, were thinking, "Oh, they're doing that now to try to keep people from staying," and hence the testimony would stop. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that was happening. I think that they're honestly just trying to, like, maintain the cleanliness of the Capitol, which they did a wonderful job of doing overall.
Okay. So you were at the Capitol the night that the budget bill received a vote.
In the Assembly. The senators were still in Illinois.
Okay. How was it that you learned that was happening?
This was just actually a convenient night for me to spend the night in the Capitol. I found out that it was being rammed through and being passed by the commotion in the rotunda. Some people watching the live feed heard that and started talking about it and got a little louder.
Okay. All right. So let's see. What was? Do you have a sense for how many people were sleeping at the Capitol the night that you were there, or I mean, how crowded at least your area seemed
to be?
It
was quite crowded. I got a little niche for a while, and I knew there was a chance I would have to move, but all the places where I knew I wouldn't have to move for a fact, we'd been told, they were full.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was every nook and, you know, quite a few nook and crannies where we're filled.
Okay.
Yeah. But not to the obstruction of anyone trying to walk around.
Okay. All right. I don't know if you have anything else you'd like to add, or
probably not.
All right. Well, I want to thank you again, Ellen, for sharing more information about your experience.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right. Thank you.